Please rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you. Y'all can be seated. Thank you very much. All right. Good morning, folks. It's good to see you. Good to see you today. Justices Goodwin, Smith, and I would like to welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. We've got one case set at this time slot this morning. We do have one waiting in the wings at 10 o'clock today. The case that is set today is 0321-00098CV, Luminant Energy Company, LLC, versus Public Utility Commission of Texas. This matter is being recorded and shown live via YouTube during the pandemic, and to make this proceeding more accessible to the public, we've made our hearings available via YouTube, although some folks are actually here in the courtroom in person. The audio and video recordings of this proceeding will be made available later this afternoon on the court's website and the court's YouTube channel. Because of the number of parties related to this case, each side is allocated a little bit more time and will receive approximately 30 minutes to argue on both sides. And the parties have worked graciously with our court clerk, Mr. Kyle, to coordinate how the speakers today will allocate their time. So for clarity, Ms. Ho will be presenting the argument on behalf of Luminant and all the other appellate interveners. I don't plan on introducing all the interveners because I want us to just leap right off into the case. The exception to that is two entities, two LLCs, DGSP2 LLC and Distributed Generation Solutions LLC. Those two interveners will be represented by Ms. Castaneda, and she'll be arguing for 10 minutes on their behalf. Then we'll turn the floor over to the Public Utility Commission, and Ms. Bennett will be arguing for 20 minutes, and Ms. Stokes will argue on behalf of one of the interveners on the PUC side of the case, and that's Calpine Corporation and Talon Energy Corporation. Then Ms. Ho will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll be looking forward to those arguments this morning. We do, as you know, the participants here know that we have a time warning system to assist the attorneys to know when to wrap up. When the yellow light comes on, that's a warning that you've got 2 minutes to wrap up your argument or that segment of your argument. When the red light comes on, that signals the conclusion of your time. The judges may ask you further questions at their leisure and discretion and possibly provide you with more time. But because we've got another case waiting in the wings, we want to be conscious of our time this morning. At this point, I'd like to call the case for ready announcements from the attorneys. And counsels, if you please introduce yourself and announce ready. And I'd like to hear from those that are speaking this morning. If you just say your name, and then we'll get started.
Good morning, Your Honors. Allison Hill, ready for Lumen.
All right, thank you.
Krista Castaneda, ready for DGS and DGSB2.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Bennett for the Public Utility Commission.
Thank you.
Macy Breezer-Stokes, ready for Calpine and Talon.
All right, wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Ho.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. We're here today because the PUC turned a reliability concern into a financial crisis by fixing the price of electricity and not the problem. In the middle of the winter storm, in a 6-minute meeting on an hour's notice, the PUC abandoned the market-based approach commanded by the legislature and fixed the price of electricity at the cap, wreaking havoc on market participants and consumers alike. The rule should be invalidated and declared ineffective for at least two fundamental independent reasons. First, it's procedurally invalid because the PUC didn't even try to comply with the Administrative Procedure Act. The PUC concedes it didn't comply with regular rulemaking, and it concedes it wasn't even trying to comply with emergency rulemaking. So it's not surprising that the PUC ended up missing 100% of the shots it didn't take. Most crucially, the PUC never took the basic step of filing the adopted rule with the Secretary of State. Filing may be mechanical, but it is essential to legal effectiveness.
If the question is just whether or not it was procedurally potentially invalid, and this court were to find that, what's the relief that should be accorded in that instance? And is it possible that they just simply adopt the same rule that was already there, assuming it's a rule again?
Thank you, Your Honor. Our view is that if this court invalidates the rule as procedurally invalid, then as this court held in Witcher, the rule has no legal effect. And so what would happen at that point if the court declares the rule invalid and ineffective, which is the remedy we're seeking, then in the pending ADR proceedings, which we have going with respect to the invoices, that would mean that those proceedings would be governed by a lawful rule on remand. So that would be the relief we would be seeking.
So there's no distinction between a procedurally failure to comply with the procedures versus the substantive, the merits question of the rule is, I guess, what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, not in this case, Your Honor, because the rule wasn't filed, it's ineffective and it's essentially null in the same way that because the rule is substantively invalid as well, it too is a nullity. So either procedurally or substantively, both of those paths lead to the same relief and the same result, which is that the rule is invalid, ineffective, and null and void.
And is that the reason why you're asking for a render in this case and not a remand?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in terms of our argument about substantive invalidity, that doesn't involve the question of remand at all. Even on the question of procedural invalidity, the statute is clear that this court may but does not have to remand. So even if this court were to overlook the ineffective filing of the rule, which renders it ineffective and a nullity, remand still would not be proper here because the legislature has said this court only may remand, it doesn't have to, and we think if there's ever a case that it would be appropriate for this case to move forward and not have further delay in terms of the ADR proceedings below, which involve our invoices, which are based on an ineffective and invalid rule, we think it would be this case.
So had they filed with the Secretary of State, done the same process, but filed it with the Secretary of State, would we be here today?
Yes, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, even if they had filed it, our position is that the rule doesn't comply with any of the other requirements under the APA for rulemaking. The PUC concedes that they didn't follow the regular rulemaking requirements. They claim that they somehow stumbled into substantial compliance with the emergency rulemaking requirements. But even apart from filing, not surprisingly, because they weren't trying to comply with those requirements, they didn't. So that would be on the procedural end of things. Even if the PUC had followed the rules procedurally, our position is that the rule is substantively invalid because it contravenes specific statutory language. And when the legislature amended the Public Utility Regulatory Act, or PURA, in 1999, it made two major changes that directly bear on this case. It separated generators who produce electricity from utilities who transmit electricity. And it commanded the PUC to stop taking a regulatory approach to generators and to start taking a competitive approach to generators. At the same time, it commanded the PUC to continue taking a regulatory approach to utilities. And it's difficult to imagine a more textbook case of a regulatory action than setting prices by agency fiat. But that's exactly what the PUC did here.
How do we take into account the situation, as you mentioned, that it was an emergency situation, the winter storm, all that? what weight do we give to that when we're looking at this?
It's a great question, Your Honor, and I think the answer to that is that the legislature already took emergency situations into account when it provided streamlined procedures for agencies to follow during times of emergencies. So the legislature was sensitive to the needs of agencies to be able, in times of emergency, to act quickly and efficiently. But the PUC is not free to ignore the legislature's requirements for even during emergency rulemaking. And I think even and perhaps especially during times of emergency, it is not too much to ask the government, state agencies, the PUC, just like everyone else, to follow the rules and follow the law even during times of emergency, Your Honor. And again, setting aside the procedural issues, even if the agency had followed the procedural rules, our position is that the rule is independently invalid and ineffective because it's substantively invalid. And I think in terms of how the easiest way to explain why the rule is substantively invalid is that the PUC admits as much when it claims that what it really did here was to issue a rate-setting order. I think that makes crystal clear that the PUC contravened specific statutory language, overstepped its statutory bounds, and adopted a rule that is invalid and ineffective for that reason, too. To say a little bit more about procedural invalidity, I think as an initial matter, there's very little question here, I think, that the price-setting rule is a rule that must satisfy the APA requirements. It checks every box of the APA's definition of a rule as a state agency statement of general applicability that implements, interprets, or prescribes law or policy. It sets a market-wide price, which is a statement of pricing policy that applied generally to the entire wholesale electricity market, including market participants who were obligated to pay that price and who faced and still face financial obligations based on that price. Contrary to the PUC's argument in its brief, the price-setting rule wasn't just an internal directive. That argument fails as a matter of text, precedent, and plain common sense. The whole point of the PUC's action was to set the price at which all participants in the wholesale electricity market would buy and sell electricity. And by fixing prices for the entire wholesale electricity market, the rule affected the private rights of market participants and consumers alike. Any other conclusion would conflict with the Texas Supreme Court's decision in El Paso Hospital District, which held that an internal agency policy directed only to agency employees about how to calculate cutoff dates for hospital reimbursements was a rule because it affected the hospital's private rights. And that's at 2079 Southwest 3rd at 714 through 15. And the same is true here. Once the price-setting rule is seen for the rule that it plainly is, it's just as plain that it doesn't pass muster under the APA because the PUC wasn't even trying to satisfy the APA. The best the PUC can do now is argue that it unintentionally complied with the emergency rulemaking procedures, and even then that it only substantially complied with those already streamlined requirements, as we were just discussing, Your Honor. But again, it would be surprising if that were true, because the PUC admits that it didn't even try to comply. Its main argument is that it didn't have to. Unsurprisingly, the PUC didn't somehow stumble into substantial compliance, because among other things, it never filed the rule with the Secretary of State, which means the rule never went into effect, which is why, in this case, Your Honor, the whole voidable distinction really doesn't matter. To be effective, the APA requires a rule, including an emergency rule, to be filed with the Secretary for publication in the Texas Register. And filing may be mechanical, but it is essential to legal effectiveness. It's like the enrolling and engrossing process in the legislature. If it isn't done, the bill never becomes a law. Or like serving a lawsuit on a defendant. If it isn't done, then the lawsuit is never initiated. Here, the rule was never filed with the Secretary of State, and it never took effect, regardless of whether the PUC posted on its website or shouted it from the rooftops. The effective date of the rule, that provision, isn't subject to substantial compliance. And a rule that hasn't gone into effect can't be remanded, as we were discussing, Your Honor. It's just a nullity, and this court should declare it so.
And so doesn't that play into their argument of mootness? Well, if it's a nullity and you know, we've already charged this price to your client, and I suppose that's trickled out to the consumers of electricity during this time, and they're paying bills, but that's all over. We're done after the 5 days that this happened. Why isn't it, if it's a nullity or we've already charged it and everybody's already paid, why isn't it moot?
Thank you, Your Honor, for that question. I think it's telling, as Your Honor highlights, that the bulk of the PUC's arguments are about avoiding judicial review altogether. I think that's understandable given how flawed the rule is, both procedurally and substantively, as we've been discussing. The PUC says this case is moot because the price-setting rule has expired. But as even the PUC must grudgingly acknowledge on page 15 of its brief, the rule continues to affect Luminant and other market participants through what the PUC calls the previously issued settlement invoices. And Luminant's and other interveners' challenges to those invoices are pending and have been stayed until this case is decided and this court can rule on the validity of the rule. And whether the rule is valid or not will, at the very least, significantly affect those proceedings. And we have followed exactly the procedure that the government argued in the El Paso Hospital line of cases litigants should follow, precisely to avoid mootness. That is, we filed, as we were required to do, in a timely fashion, our validity challenge to the rule directly in this court, as PURA requires us to do. We timely filed our challenges to the invoices, and those proceedings are pending, and they too have been stayed. And so the government in the El Paso line of hospitals, as the Supreme Court in this court remarked, those cases would not have been moot. And I think the question is really, does the rule continue to have continuing effect? Can this court render relief and remedy that will matter? And absolutely yes, Your Honor, because we are entitled to have the challenges to the pending invoices decided under a rule that is lawful. And that is exactly the relief that this court can render by declaring the rule ineffective and invalid, and then in those proceedings, they will just go back to the most recent lawful rule and law that was in effect prior to the price-setting rule. But again, that is a matter that will be addressed and handled in those proceedings on remand. But I think the critical issue here is there is still continuing effect. So this isn't a case where this court can't really accomplish anything by declaring the rule invalid. The rule, as this court said in Ben Robertson, it used the phrase continuing effect, and I think that's a really good descriptor of what we're talking about here, kind of setting aside the legal jargon of mootness and invalidity. The rule does have a continuing effect. It has a continuing effect in the proceedings below that are being stayed for this court's decision. And I think as the Supreme Court recognized in the city of in the Loewenberg case, I think it's worth quoting in full because I think it really applies in this case as well. It said an agency can't extract millions in unlawful fees and fines, decide the whole thing was a mistake, keep the money, and insist the whole matter is moot. For those who paid, just as we did with our invoices, the controversy remains real.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm. So if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Castaneda.
May it please the court, I'm going to refer to my clients collectively as DGS throughout this discussion. Thank you. DGS appeals, but only from the second emergency order. DGS contends that the first emergency order entered on February 15th was a valid exercise of the Commission's emergency rulemaking power. But the second order, which was identical to the first, except did 180-degree shift on its direction to ERCOT not to reprice the first 16 hours of Winter Storm Uri and Emergency Alert 3, was an invalid exercise of the court's emergency powers. In fact, it complied not at all with the requirements of emergency rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act. And it is from this 216 order that DGS appeals and asks this court to reverse and void that order.
Reverse and render.
Yes, I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor. Nope, thank you, Your Honor. Leaving in, and just to be clear on this, leaving in place the first order, which directed ERCOT to properly reprice all periods after the system entered EEA 3. Now, of course, the APA requires that the PUC have made a finding of imminent peril to public health or safety and to have recited those findings in the preamble to the order adopting the rule.
Council, did they file the first order with the Secretary of State?
They did not, Your Honor, but I do believe, in response to the earlier questions, that this court can reverse for compliance with that technical detail. So much has been done based on the fact that the price of electricity was properly $9,000 throughout the course of this EEA 3 event. But the second order meets none of the requirements. Because it is identical to the first one, it makes no new findings of an emergency. Why the PUC would tell ERCOT to not do what it is normally required to do, which is to reprice in connection with the nodal protocols and the regulations that were already in place.
So that sentence brings me to a question that I've been trying to figure out how to weave into what we've already heard from. So on a rule validity challenge, PURA limits our consideration to those things that were before the PUC and what they relied on when they were adopting the rule. What do we get to consider here? Because there's a whole lot of other stuff that's in our record. And relatedly, then what do we do? How do we consider ERCOT's actions post-rule? So two things. What can we hear? What can we look at? And then what do we do with ERCOT's response? Because if the protocol, well, I think you know where I'm going.
I do. Thank you, Your Honor, for that question. As the court knows, this is a very limited record for this direct appeal under PURA 39.001. The notice of the hearing, any comments that were properly filed before the hearing, any studies relied on by the commission, and the order are the sole contents of the record before this court on appeal. That is what the court is bound to consider. And we know, because the supplemental record that contains the transcript of the hearing, the commission's proceedings on these matters, establishes that there were none of either the properly filed comments or any kinds of studies. They were acting in an emergency basis, and they were acting based on their own knowledge and their own discernment as commissioners. And so what's particularly telling about the transcript of the second hearing, which is tab 4 to the supplemental record, is it makes clear that Commissioner Walker, Chairman Walker, felt she had made a mistake the day before, and that her sole reason for withdrawing the instruction to ERCOT to do what it was legally required to do, and in fact mandating that it not do what it's legally required to do, was that she was uncomfortable because some people had called her and told her that they were negatively impacted. That is the height of exactly what our Administrative Procedures Act is trying to prevent. And so while it is not evidence that informs whether the court made the correct decision, what it does show us is that this was an improper exercise of emergency rulemaking. And in fact, there was no emergency that required the commission to undertake that don't reprice action at that point, rather than save it for the regular docket, which was only 9 days later. It was in the past at that point. There was no emergency as a matter of just absolute
as fact. To rate making.
Well, this is not rate making.
Well,
Your Honor.
As to the rate setting, is that a better way to put it? The $9,000, that's what it is, right?
I disagree with Luminant on that. DGS contends that $9,000 was the proper price, and I will defer to Appalese to explain a lot of this. But the $9,000 price is not only a financial signal. It is a physical signal. It tells generation to come online. It tells load that you should not be online. If you can go offline and you don't want to pay $9,000, you should go offline. It has a purpose of not only balancing financial transactions, but actually making the system run.
But then what do we do with the testimony that was out there that said firm load shed had previously been considered and rejected in this instance?
Excellent question, Your Honor. Here's what I would say. The agency's findings of perhaps inconsistent things in its records are entitled to deference. What the agency also had in front of it was the fact that 16 TAC 25.505G specifically provides that the high offer cap was $9,000 and that the value of lost load, VOLL, should be priced at $9,000. And so what the agency did was determine that, yes, in fact, in this situation, our regulations, as we interpret them, require the price to be at $9,000. While Luminant has an argument about something that was not adopted many years prior, that's not how the regulatory framework played out at the time that this particular emergency came to be. The Texas Administrative Code regulations are fairly clear that the lost load should have been valued at $9,000, that this was an important equivalent to a tornado siren to call up all available power and to tell people who could go without to go without. And that's why the price was properly $9,000. What the commission did in the first order was not establish a different rule. It didn't amend the rule. It said, this is the rule that should be being executed, and our software is not working. And therefore, we need to intervene and make sure that the rule is implemented as we expect it to be. Compare and contrast the second order, however. We've got lots of regulations that actually require ERCOT to reprice, and particularly in the case of a software or hardware error, when prices are not being printed correctly, the rules require ERCOT to go back and reprice. So PUC's rule that ERCOT will not go back and reprice in this particular instance clearly violates the existing rulemaking and the existing regulations.
I want to ask a question about these orders. So the second one, doesn't it just kind of amend the first order? Isn't it?
Maybe that's what they were trying to do, but even if it was an amendment of the first order, they should have complied with the emergency procedures of the APA. What was the emergency that required them to deal with this issue of whether we reprice? There was a whole lot of financial transactions that were going to have to be worked out after the fact and are still being worked out after the fact. What was the emergency that was before them to require them to say, don't reprice, contrary to existing regulations, and have to do it on the 16th, rather than taking it up in the regular course of administrative business that the PUC regularly deals with? If there was a reason, which all available indicia suggest there wasn't a reason other than people were uncomfortable because they were trading on prices that were too low for what was required by law, then the commission did not state it in the order, and it fails to comply with the emergency procedures of the APA. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Much appreciated. Ms. Bennett.
Thank you. May it please the court. This lawsuit seeks to second guess, with the benefit of hindsight, the PUC's directions to its designated system operator, ERCOT, to weather the once-in-a-lifetime winter storm that struck Texas in February 2021. While residential customers were suffering from blackouts called upon to keep the grid from collapsing, ERCOT's pricing calculations were reacting as if those people had just turned off their lights and didn't need the energy. Exercising its oversight authority over ERCOT, the PUC directed ERCOT to ensure that that scarcity being experienced was reflected in energy prices, consistent with market design and the PUC's rules.
So the scarcity, isn't that supposed to be about having adequate generation, not the generation failing because of other outside forces, including the storm?
It can be about both. I think this was a time when the sort of widespread nature of the failures of generation was unprecedented, but I think that's experienced in more limited ways at other times. But the scarcity pricing considers both the supply and the demand side. And the system is set up so that scarcity pricing will incentivize generation, both in the short and the long term, to be built, to be able to come online quickly in this kind of an emergency. And then also on the demand side, to discourage industrial uses, for example, that can go offline to preserve the ability for residential consumers to have that power. Appellants' procedural and substantive challenges to the PUC's actions fail on their merits, as well as for several jurisdictional reasons. And I'd like to begin with the appropriate characterization of the PUC's action as a direction to ERCOT and not as a rulemaking, because that issue is dispositive both of this court's appellate jurisdiction on a direct appeal and also whether the challenge falls within the limited waiver of sovereign immunity for rule validity challenges. So the orders are not rules as defined in the APA for two reasons. First, the PUC is charged with exercising complete oversight over ERCOT, and its directions to ERCOT were part of that oversight. And second, the orders direct ERCOT to bring its calculations into line with PUC rules and market principles that were already in place. In Texas Mutual versus Vista, this court explained that internally directed statements that produce clarity of direction in a highly technical area are not rules. The directive in the order did just that. The directive, just to read it out loud, was to ensure that firm load that is being shed in EEA 3 is accounted for in ERCOT's scarcity pricing signals. And the PUC noted that it believed that what was happening contrary to that was against the entire design of the ERCOT market. If all such PUC oversight over ERCOT had to be done through the straitjacket of rulemaking, it would cripple the PUC's oversight function that the legislature provided for separate from its rulemaking and contested case roles. Moreover, we've talked a lot about the ERCOT protocols and what was or was not in place and what was considered. As an initial matter, that's sort of a legislative history of ERCOT argument. There are a lot of reasons to include or not include load shed at the particular place that was being identified. One of those reasons is that ERCOT's rules also include a curve called the ORDC, Operating Resources Demand Curve, that says if reserves drop below 2,000, then you go up to the HCAP price, which is the $9,000 price we're talking about. Here we were at negative reserves, but the price wasn't going up as it was supposed to under the ERCOT rules. And that's something that was acknowledged even by the parent company of appellants, Luminant, in an earnings call. They acknowledged that when you've got negative reserve, you should be at that cap. But moreover, ERCOT's protocols are not APA rulemakings themselves. There's case law talking about the idea that the protocols have the force and effect of rules, and that's true when you're interpreting what
those come from this court, right?
That's right.
Right.
And the Constellation Energy case is the main case that talks about that. But what those are doing is interpreting protocols and saying we're going to apply this sort of the same statutory and rule interpretation principles to protocols, and we consider them binding on ERCOT. That doesn't mean they're APA rules. They were enacted through a stakeholder process, but not an APA process. So here, to the extent that the argument is that PUC has changed a protocol that had decided not to include a certain element. We're kind of two steps removed from what would be an APA rulemaking in this case.
And so is really, there no means to challenge the change to a protocol?
So you can challenge the change to a protocol through the administrative process.
Which
where you
is
go.
Ongoing down in the court below, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
So, and in fact, since the winter storm, a major change that has been made is ERCOT has adopted in its protocols a price adder that would do a similar thing to what this is doing. So we're not going to see this case again with the PUC issuing an order to ERCOT that's having the effect of saying, hey, you need to make sure you're going to the cap, because now it's clearly in the ERCOT protocols to the extent it wasn't before. And there's already one challenge to that that's been brought in this court, actually, as a direct appeal. We're arguing there, too, that that's not the appropriate vehicle, that it should be through the administrative process, which, of course, then does percolate up through judicial review. But that would be the mechanism to review this in the future. That sort of brings me to the issue of mootness and redressability. So I'd like to turn to that. And the analysis is a little bit different for the procedural and the substantive claims here. For the procedural claims, the mootness point is a lot more clear, I think. Under Section 2001.040 of the APA, the appellant's procedural claims at best would allow the court to invalidate the rule effective as of the date of the court's order. The court can remand, and that would be the normal course to remand to cure.
Wouldn't that be the case where what we're looking at is whether or not there's substantial compliance with the rulemaking procedures, correct?
Right. So,
and what about those portions like the filing with the Secretary of State where there is no such substantial compliance type language? What do we do with that?
Yeah, well, I would disagree with that. So the requirement that a state agency shall file an emergency rule in the office of the Secretary of State for publication in the Texas Register in the manner prescribed by Chapter 2002 is found in Section 2001.034 of the APA, which is one of the sections that's subject to the substantial compliance standard in 2001.035. So the procedure of the state agency being required to file it with the Secretary of State is absolutely subject to the substantial compliance standard. And I think substantial compliance can be found here. Here, obviously, the PUC didn't file this with the Secretary of State as a rulemaking because of its view that it was exercising oversight over ERCOT. However, it did file detailed open meeting notices with the Secretary of State, and those describe the imminent peril that they're talking about and do a lot of the things that a preamble to, you know, an emergency rulemaking would do. So I believe you can find substantial compliance there. And moreover, Section 2001.035D of the APA instructs that technical defects are not grounds for invalidation of a rule unless the appellants have experienced prejudice from that. And so on both of the points where they say that there were procedural defects, there's no actual prejudice flowing from them. So first on the Secretary—
Aren't there a lot of companies that went bankrupt because of this? And that's not prejudice, I take it.
Well, the prejudice would have to flow from the procedural defects for the procedural claim. For the substantive claim, we're not making that kind of an argument. Okay. This is just whether if the PUC had filed, sent the email to the Secretary of State saying this is an emergency rulemaking, which would always be after they had adopted it in the case of emergency rulemaking. It's not done before and providing opportunity for notice and comment. Would that have changed anything for them if the agency had sent that email to the Secretary of State? And the answer is no. And it's especially so because no party claims that they did not receive actual notice of the order. And PUC and ERCOT went to great lengths to ensure actual notice. ERCOT sent out a market notice summarizing the orders, linking to them, that went out by an email blast to their entire distribution list. And across all the briefs in this case, no one has alleged that they didn't actually know about this in a very timely fashion. And then, of course, the open meeting notices were filed with the Secretary of State, so there was notice there, too. When we're talking about the filing with the Secretary of State, not only would it have been after the, you know, the putative rulemaking had been adopted. But the Texas Register doesn't even come out except once a week. So it would have been after the entire storm was over that they would have gotten the notice. So the idea that that would be better as actual notice than what they got doesn't really track with the reality of the situation. There was also substantial compliance with stating that there was an emergency. As I noted before, there were already in the Secretary of State open meeting filings, there was already a description of imminent peril that used those words. And then in the orders themselves, they repeatedly said, you know, the governor had declared a disaster. ERCOT had declared its highest state of emergency. It independently concluded that a public emergency exists and that it was necessary to ensure appropriate energy prices during the system emergency, and so on. There are many different descriptions of an emergency. So the fact that they weren't laid out in a section called preamble, or perhaps elaborated on as much as you would in a sort of notice and comment rulemaking, does not mean that it didn't substantially comply if the court were to find that this was something that should have been done as rulemaking, mm-hmm. as opposed to as an exercise of oversight. The substance of the claims, too, is also important to address. Here, the claims concern statutory authority. PURA Section 39.151D grants PUC the broad authority to adopt and enforce rules relating to the reliability of the regional electric network and accounting for the production and delivery of electricity among generators and other market participants. The Texas Supreme Court has held that the legislature essentially anticipated that PURA would comprehend all or virtually all pertinent considerations involving electric utilities operating in Texas. This is an extremely broad grant of legislative authority. And appellants make three primary arguments that this ran afoul of the statutory authority. The main one that we've heard about today is this idea that the PUC came in and suddenly dictated a regulatory price, mm-hmm. contra to PURA. And there are a few responses to that. First, PURA provides that competitive rather than regulatory methods should be used to the greatest extent feasible. That's in section 39.001D. So it's not the exclusive mechanism. And that's especially true when PURA also charges the PUC with ensuring reliability. Second, accounting for load shed
in that PUC ensuring reliability, how did PUC's actions ensure reliability for the entire 5-day period? Because in reading some of the briefs, it didn't change that we had more energy out there. Mm-hmm. So how did your actions do what you're tasked to do by the legislature?
Yeah, there are a few ways to think about this. One, I would refer your honors to the materials concerning the adoption of PUC's scarcity pricing mechanism in the first mm-hmm. place. And that talks a lot about why the price, you know, the HCAP should be set at 9,000, and how is that going to incentivize both short and long-term electricity generation. That's the framework that already existed that the PUC was operating within, and that was kind of the reasoning underlying that. So then the question is, you know, what did this actually do in reality? And did the PUC, you know, can we charge them with considering sort of what happened now after the fact? And this kind of goes to Justice Goodwin's question from earlier. 2020 hindsight, you know, you might come up with a different result. That's sort of always the case in policymaking. And in fact, since the winter storm, the PUC has engaged in rulemaking that has brought the HCAP price down to 5,000, so that the total price tag next time won't be as high. And that's kind of the iterative policymaking changes that you would expect to see. In terms of what actually did happen during the storm, though,
related to that, yeah. then, is also the excerpts in the record that show that the firm load shed was expressly considered and rejected as a means for tagging for queuing the $9,000 rate. or at least that's my understanding of some of the statements in the record. Modification of that, isn't that a rule?
This is kind of where the distinction between ERCOT protocols and the rules come into place. So the PUC never considered and rejected load shed as something that should be considered. That's something that was taking place in the ERCOT stakeholder processes. And all we have is basically in the list of price adders in one piece of the ERCOT protocols, an early draft had firm load shed on the list, and then it's crossed out in a later version.
But given this court's holding that those protocols are rules, same question.
Right, so two things. I mean, one, to my point earlier, they are not APA rules, and so a change to them that was made by ERCOT would not be done through the APA. So PUC making a change to them, saying that that has to be the APA when PUC has this oversight authority over ERCOT and can review their protocols and everything else, is a little bit of a stretch. Also, though, the protocols themselves, if you just kind of look to the other binding rules of ERCOT, there's the operating resources demand curve that does provide that if your reserve is below 2,000, you're supposed to be at cap. And so that's kind of conflicting with this idea of not including load shed in unexpected ways. And then also in protocol 6.5.9.1, it provides that the protocols do not preclude ERCOT from taking any action to preserve the integrity of the ERCOT system. And it's specifically talking about emergencies in those cases. So it appears that the protocols themselves do allow for ERCOT to go a different way during an emergency. And so then PUC doing that same thing in its exercise of oversight shouldn't be subjected to an APA rulemaking standard.
And I appreciate your patience with me asking all these questions,
sure.
But as the parties know, I was brought into this a little bit late, so I'm doing some serious catching up. So I want to make sure I understand what you're suggesting, and I'm kind of trying to distill it down to a very simple statement. I think I hear you telling me that the PUC telling ERCOT how to apply protocols is not a rule.
Correct.
Okay.
And their instruction to ERCOT, moreover, brought them into a consistent framework with PUC's existing rules and with the market structure generally, which was not the case in some of the other major cases that my friends on the other side have mentioned, like the El Paso hospital case, where the ruling was essentially that the existing rule said you had to consider 12 months, and the agency was actually considering 6 months of data. And they just found that those were in conflict. And so this couldn't possibly be sort of a restatement of a rule in a technical situation. This was actually displacing the rulemaking that had been in existence. So this case is very unlike those. Finally, I just have a couple more minutes. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the remedy issues here. We've talked about the procedural remedies being problematic because basically any voiding of the putative rulemaking on procedural grounds would run at best for appellants from the date of this court's order. It would not void it ab initio. So therefore, in all the administrative proceedings that are currently stayed, it wouldn't change the rule to be applied there. The emergency rulemaking, if invalidated on procedural grounds, would
Has no effect on the...
No, because you would apply in the administrative proceedings, you would apply the law in effect at the time. So if this court were to issue a ruling that would void the order of the rule, void ab initio, that makes it where going back it was never a valid law. So that would change, you know, the law that would be applied in administrative proceedings. But on just strictly these procedural grounds, it would just be going forward from here, anything in the future would not be affected.
So then are you telling the parties that they have to litigate that down in the courts below, and then that's going to come back up here and we're going to do it again on the substance?
If this court were to, so the procedural arguments mm-hmm. are just moot.
I know, I'm talking
for
about
those
the
reasons. On the substance, The problems with the relief are, it's sort of a mootness, redressability sort of mix, because...
Well, I mean, this is like, you know, cake and eating it too, isn't it?
I don't think
so. If they can't bring it up here, the substance, right?
Right.
They can't bring it up here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too late for the administrative proceeding below to address it.
So on the substance, they can still bring those. They can still bring those.
We just can't reach it, is what you're suggesting.
Process. What I'm suggesting here is that you can't reach it.
Okay.
And that there is a redressability problem with the relief that this court could offer, because this court cannot order PUC to take the action of ordering repricing. It can only speak to the validity of the rule and remand for proceedings consistent with that, which could mean
which
any
is too late because the administrative proceedings are already pending.
I don't think it's too late in that sense. I think it's on the procedural claims.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking the substantive.
Yeah, on the substantive claims, it's not that it's too late to do it. It's that the relief offered by this court, it's speculative that that would actually result in repricing, which is what the appellants are here trying to get.
And counsel, I see your time has wrapped up. That's okay.
I ate up a lot of it.
If you've got just a moment that you want to say your last words, because we did interrupt you in questions, and they were good questions, so thank you.
Oh, sure. Well, the PUC's order to ERCOT is an exercise of its oversight taken during an extreme emergency to bring what we're seeing on the ground into line with the expectations of all the market participants, of all the commissioners. And in doing so, they acted well within the scope of their statutory authority and acted in a procedurally appropriate manner. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. And Ms. Stokes.
May it please the court. I'd like to talk about why the retroactive repricing relief that appellants have sought here would be impossible to do with any accuracy, would be an administrative nightmare, and would have negative repercussions for both the ERCOT market, its market participants, and many consumers. It's impossible to accurately reprice the thousands of market transactions that occurred just during the 4 days of the storm more than a year later. That is, it's impossible to imagine this alternate pricing world in which the orders were never issued and there was no stable 9,000 per megawatt hour price affecting market behavior. No one, and this includes Luminant's paid study or the independent market monitor, has ever attempted to do that. That's because all we could do is speculate as to how the market participants would have behaved in the starkly different market where prices fluctuated wildly, and there was no certainty of being able to recover sky-high gas prices through power sales.
Isn't that what's going to happen in the bankruptcy proceedings? And isn't everything going to be rebalanced again, depending on what happens in those bankruptcy proceedings?
Well, no, Your Honor, I submit that repricing is not permitted under PURA, and I think the legislature thought it didn't currently require repricing because, as you know, they considered and rejected.
I thought I understood at least some of the parties to be suggesting that is going to be the effect of the bankruptcy proceedings that are currently ongoing. Am I mistaken in that? It's okay.
Well, that would not be the type of thing they're asking for here, which, okay. If you look at Texpo's brief and prayer, they asked for this court to order the PUC to reprice and resettle the entire ERCOT market, and that is not going to happen in any bankruptcy proceeding. And I think, you know, part of the reason why repricing the market would be ill-advised is because market participants took myriad actions outside the market in reliance on that $9,000 price. They hedged in the Intercontinental Exchange. They took out loans. They drew down from lines of credit. They bought gas at exorbitant prices under contracts with very severe contractual penalties. And those transactions are now final, and nothing that this court or the PUC could do could undo them. And that's true whether you're looking at those kind of ills are true even in the ADR, individual ADR context. All you're going to do there is add the woe of inconsistent outcomes.
But what should be our concern if, in fact, these were rules and they didn't go through the rulemaking process? The problems with repricing is for another day, and that may be a consequence. But if these are, in fact, rules and they didn't go through the APA process properly, it isn't government mandated to do the process properly.
So, Your Honor, I would submit under 2001.035 and 2001.040 of the APA, the court's options are a prospective invalidation or keep the orders in place, remand for the statute says to revise and readopt the rules in compliance with APA procedures. And so those are the options. So I would say at most you should send it back to do the filing. And as my colleague discussed, the filing with the Secretary of State would not have provided any more notice because every single market participant had notice of these orders. And as the APA says in 2002.002, the whole purpose of the filing with the Secretary of State requirement is to provide public notice. So the statutory purposes were satisfied here. So this is not a situation where you would need to invalidate it for failure to follow emergency rulemaking proceedings.
But did that notice, the market participants that were doing the $9,000, but did Mr. Smith down in the valley that decided to turn his lights on because it's been really cold, had he known that it's going to be a trickle down of that $9,000 for his electric bill, maybe he would have kept his lights off. Did he have notice?
Well, so, Your Honor, this is an important premise for this case, is that less than 1% of residential customers across all of ERCOT had a variable pricing plan such that the high power costs during the storm were passed to them. And most of those were gritty customers that, as Justice Goodwin mentioned, bankruptcies. Gritty filed bankruptcy, and as a result of that bankruptcy and a settlement with the Attorney General, forgave all that debt. 99%, more than 99%, the millions of ERCOT customers that are residential did not get those power costs passed down to them. And the problem with repricing is that given PURA's limitations on regulation of REPs, even if you ordered repricing and it would benefit certain reps, there'd be no way to require them to pass those benefits on to their residential consumer. So this is not a case about trying to help the residential consumer. This is a case about certain market participants wanting a do-over and repricing that would arguably punish market participants who did hedge well, who did plan well, who provided much needed energy during the storm, and reward some who didn't. I see I'm out of time. I'd be happy to take any more questions. Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank
you, counsel. And Ms. Ho, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A lot of briefs, a lot of argument. Let me make 3 points. Overarching, I want to say that on every issue in this case, jurisdiction, procedure, and substance, the PUC and its supporting interveners have staked out extreme and unprecedented positions that, if accepted, would result in administrative agencies unbound by law. Let me just go through each of those: jurisdiction, procedure, and substantive. First, on jurisdiction, the PUC's cramped view of this court's jurisdiction is really as extraordinary as it is wrong. Using a number of different labels, you know, mootness, retroactivity, redressability, remediation, the PUC takes the position that even if it unlawfully issued a rule, and even if that rule wreaked havoc on the market, there's nothing this court can do about it. And that's just a recipe for unreviewable, unaccountable agency action, and this court should reject it in no uncertain terms. We followed exactly the path to relief that the state itself endorsed in the El Paso Hospital line of cases. We've challenged the invoices in ADR proceedings, and those proceedings have been abated pending this court's judgment on the validity of the rule. So there's no issue with retroactivity here. We have pending administrative proceedings, and if this court, as it should, as we respectfully ask the court to do, declares the price setting rule invalid, that will simply, but crucially, allow Luminant and others to have lawful rules applied in their pending ADR proceedings. Second, procedure. If this court approves what the PUC did in this case as substantial compliance, then the APA's procedural requirements are essentially a dead letter. This is not a case where an agency, you know, tried to follow the rules and just didn't dot its I's or cross its T's. This is a case where the agency wholly disregarded the APA's rulemaking procedures, and to this day, today, maintains it had no obligation to follow those procedures. It's difficult to imagine a scenario where an agency could do less than what the PUC did here because it did nothing. In particular, it did not file the rule. And with respect to my friend on the other side, the filing requirement and the requirement, the statutory provision that we rely on for the proposition that filing is essential to the effectiveness of the rule is 2001.036, which is not subject to substantial compliance or remand. And that is about legal effectiveness, not notice. And that's precisely why the emergency rules have an additional notice requirement in them, precisely because there is no notice requirement on the outset and on the back end. So filing is about effectiveness. It's about legal effectiveness. It's not about notice. The emergency rulemaking procedures that the legislature has put in place are not difficult to follow. The PUC could have filed its rules in this case in minutes with the click of an email. It's not too much to ask the PUC to do what everyone else has to do, and that's follow the rules and the law. Third, substance. PURA instructs the PUC to use, quote, competitive rather than regulatory methods, and directs it to adopt rules that are both practical and limited so as to impose the least impact on competition. That's 39001D. But the PUC's unprecedented decision to fix prices at 9,000 is the very antithesis of competition. If the PUC has the power to fix prices, then there is no market. There is no competition. And if the legislature had wanted the PUC to have such unbounded absolute power, it would have said so. But instead, it said just the opposite. So in closing, should the PUC prevail here, there would be nothing left to check it on jurisdiction, unreviewable power in emergencies, on procedure, no obligation to even try to follow the law, and on substance, no limit on interfering with competition. Neither the APA nor this court's precedents allow those results, and we respectfully ask this court to declare the price-setting rule invalid and ineffective. And if there are no further questions, I'll yield back the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. We really appreciate the well-briefed, many briefs, and we will try to get back with you as quickly as we can on a decision, but there is a lot of work to do. This court stands in recess. Thank you very much.